We can use some of their incentives account, we can actually put our stuff.
Easy to mess with.
Okay, we'll go ahead and get started.
I'm convinced I'll send you a public records request tomorrow.
I'll answer it.
I will open the Subcommittee on Natural Resources meeting for April 6, 2015. The item on the agenda is an opening of public hearing on HB 5042, the Oregon Water Resources Department. Mr. Byler, will you come forward and does LFO have anything preliminarily to provide?
I can just give you a brief overview.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the Subcommittee. Today we're going to hear a public testimony, or public hearing, I'm sorry, on the Oregon Water Resources Department's budget bill. Oregon Water Resources Department has two large budget areas. The first one is their water development loan program, and then their water resources program. The loan program is, as it sounds, is a standalone loan program, and their development program encompasses five operational divisions: the administrative services, field services, technical services, water rights services, and the director's office. The governor's budget includes two major divisions, I would say, this time around. First of all, there's $50 million in bond funding, which won't necessarily go through too much in this subcommittee. That'll be taken care of by the capital construction subcommittee. But there are some positions that are associated with that bonding that I'm sure the agency is going to want to discuss through their presentation. And then the second piece are just ongoing issues with the agency, ongoing operational goals of the agency, and they're going to include some positions about, I think, six positions is correct, outside of the bonding-related positions. But other than that, the agency is pretty straightforward at the current service level. They are carrying forward funding that was provided by the legislature in House Bill 839 for the Water Development Loan Program. Not all of that money got allocated during the current biennium, so they're carrying forward a portion of that funding into this coming biennium, along with adding to that amount with the bonding program that's proposed.
Mr. Byler.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Byler. I'm the director of the Oregon Water Resources Department, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning and this week to present the governor's proposed budget for 2015-2017 for our agency. I want to just do a little bit of orientation around the next few days and give you a sense of the timing that we think we'll use and kind of the areas that we'll talk about today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. But before I do that, I want to note that I'm in April. I was celebrating 6 months on the job. I started in October of 2014, and it's been very gratifying and exhilarating ride for me here at the agency. One of the things that has been very clear to me right from the get-go is how dedicated and excellent our staff are at the agency. In all locations, both Salem and in the field, just very dedicated, hardworking staff. I have a few of those folks here today who I may call upon occasion as questions come up that I'm unable to answer, but I want to just introduce them to you today, if I could, just briefly, and I'll ask them to identify themselves as I call them off. First of all, Tom Paul, our deputy director. Brenda Bateman, who's the administrator of our technical services division. Tracy Loudon, who is our Administrative Services Division Administrator. Dwight French, who is our Water Rights Services Division Administrator. Doug Woodcock, who leads our Field Services Division. And Raquel Rancier, who you've probably seen around the building a few times now and then, who's our Senior Policy Coordinator and our point person on legislative and policy matters. This is our executive team for the agency, a great group of people, very grateful to be working with them. Again, as questions arise, I may ask them to join me up here if I'm unable to respond to your questions. So with that, in terms of the organization of our presentation, I think you have a presentation binder, and certainly we'll be going through a PowerPoint today. We have, within our presentation binder, I think there are nine chapters, nine different sections. We'll be walking through six of those over the course of the next 3 days. The first it will be today. We'll be talking about agency overview, and then we'll go into the divisions of the agency and walk through those, how we're organized, what those different divisions do, with a little bit of depth. Tomorrow morning, I believe you'll hear from Richard Whitman, and he'll be providing a brief overview of the governor's perspective on this agency's budget. And then I'll dive into agency performance summary, performance measures, key performance measures. And then with our remaining time, we'll start to talk about the budget drivers around things that influence what we do and how we prioritize our activities. And then the fifth element would be the governor's budget itself. And then with vacancies and reductions would be the last piece. There are additional elements in our presentation binder, and if you have, I'm not planning on to talk about those, but if you have questions about those over the course of the next 3 days, please don't hesitate to ask. So with that, I think I'll dive into this presentation. And here is a picture overlooking an area in the near the Dalles. And what I want to frame up for this agency overview is there's a real element with the Water Resources Department and with our policies of past, present, and future, maybe more than you would see with most natural resources agencies. Our history has a pretty major influence on what we do now, today, and also influences our decisions as we cast our eyes forward into what our options are around water supply in the future. Our agency is the agency that oversees the management and distribution of water quantity, the use of water. And as you all know, this is an incredibly valuable resource that means a lot for our communities, whether it's to supply irrigation water for agricultural purposes, which is a major engine of our economy, or supplying water for our municipalities and folks that need drinking water and other multiple uses within our communities. Water's a big deal. And who gets the water and when they get it is always an issue of great importance. It supports livelihoods and it supports lives. And we take our job very seriously in terms of managing the distribution system that we have according to the laws that we have to carry out. So with this section, I'm going to talk a little bit about the history. I'm going to go into some of the water law basics. These are building blocks that I think are important for you to have some sense of. It will help you understand how our agency functions at the division level. Talk about some of the changes in the law over the years. So with that, here we have a map from 1872. It's a rain chart of the United States, the lower 48, which I guess in that time, Hawaii and Alaska weren't part of the Union, as you know. And what you can see here are, in very basic terms, are as you look at Texas, kind of East Texas, and going east, you'll see blue section. And to the west, you'll see a kind of a tan or white area other than the Pacific Northwest, which has some blue shading west of the Cascade Range. And this is essentially precipitation. This shows areas that are wet and dry. And if it's blue, it gets pretty good precipitation. If it's not blue, it's pretty dry. And the point here is that in 1872, this was an era in the second half of the 19th century where folks were starting to settle the west. They were moving westward. And they needed water to be able to carry out their interests at that time. When you look at the map of the United States here, that blue area is an area of abundant water. The western states are arid, and different regimes for controlling and managing water developed as a result of that. In the eastern states, because water was plentiful, they developed what they call the riparian doctrine, which allowed for people who lived adjacent to water courses, and there are many of them, they were able to use that water relatively without being impeded by others. In the west, there's a lot less water available, and we developed different system to be able to manage the use of that very valuable resource. In this next slide, you'll see on the left is a notice to a claim of water use from 1878, and it's by a fellow who is claiming use in it's Shirttail Gulch. Shirttail Gulch, if you didn't know this, and I didn't know it until I saw this and looked into it, is a little gulch area just adjacent to Interstate 84 in between Baker City and Ontario. And if you've ever been through that area, you'll know it's kind of dry in that area. This claim in 1878 was to 500 inches of water and for mining, mechanical, and agricultural purposes. The main point here is that as people began to come across from the east to the west and settle in the in Oregon, they made uses of water, and they would make claims to those uses dating back to the mid and later half of the 19th century. In the bottom right-hand corner, I would just point out to you that this is a picture of the main canal of the Klamath Project. That's a major water delivery system for irrigation and agricultural purposes down in the Klamath Basin. Investments were being made not only by individuals, but organized efforts and significant efforts to move water onto lands and develop those lands for the benefit of the communities. What's important to recognize here again, and this is again reaching back to the past, is that as these uses were being made, they have implications on future options in terms of how we use water. It wasn't until 1909 that the state adopted a code for the regulation and distribution of water. And one of the basic premises for this is that these statutes declare that all water is public. It's a public source. And that people have the ability to be able to make use of that water. And water, when we talk about water rights, it is the permission to be able to use that public resource, surface water, groundwater, to store water, et cetera. It's not a clear ownership, but instead, again, the ability to be able to use that water. There are within that ability to be able to use a water right, there are four key elements to bear in mind. One is that water must be beneficially used. You have to not waste that water. You have to be able to put it to purposes, and there are a wide range of beneficial uses, agriculture and irrigation purposes being a predominant one, but there are many others. Another element is that water must be used. You have to continue to use that water in order to be able to retain your right. If you don't use it, you can lose it. So that's another element that is key to this system, this prior appropriation system. And then a pertinency is another major element. That essentially means that the water is attached to the land where it's used. And in very simple terms, what that means is that if you have a farmer who has irrigation right on his property and he decides to sell the property and move to another area, he can't take that water right with him. That water right stays with the land. It's an important element. That land then retains value and again, is attached to the place of use. And the last element here is kind of the key element of that really drives many of our management decisions for our work, and that is first in time, first in right. We're based on a seniority system for the distribution of water around the state. Folks who have senior water rights are going to be protected to in times of shortage, water shortage. They will have more reliable source of water in the future, or during times of dry years. And so let me illustrate that a little bit here with this next slide. So under the prior appropriation doctrine, and Western water law. Imagine that this, the blue line here is a river and it's flowing towards us. And upstream, you'll see a 1970 water right holder. And then downstream is a 1910 water right holder. In a dry year, that senior user might find that there's not enough flow coming down the stream to meet the needs under its water rights. In that situation, the senior water right holder can call the water master and say, hey, I'd like to make a call. I want to make sure that I'm getting all the water I'm entitled to. And the water master would then go to the 1970 water right holder and shut him off in order to be able to allow water to flow past that 1970 diversion and meet and get to the 1910 water right in order for them to be able to meet their needs. So this is a very, very important element because this is a kind of a key foundational concept of how we go about our business. And so when folks talk about the Water Resources Department taking regulatory action, by and large, a lot of it has to do with the distribution of water in accordance with protecting senior water right holders. So over the years, since the advent of the state code, we've seen some advancements and refinements to the law, and some of them are significant, and I wanted to mention those just briefly to you today. Before I go into those, though, I do want to emphasize that the management and distribution of water quantity around the state, the use of water around the state, is a state responsibility. There is no federal agency counterpart to what we do. This is something that the state has a primary authority over, and something that Oregon and many of the other western states who have similar legal regimes that we hang on to very tightly. And so with our code, one thing that I wanted to mention here after the 1909 adoption of the code, in 1955, the legislature recognized groundwater source specifically in the statutes and essentially applied the same prior appropriation system to groundwater. So again, senior groundwater users will have preference and priority over junior groundwater users who may share the same aquifer. During that time period, at that same time, there was also a legislative recognition that surface water and groundwater can be hydraulically connected, and that that we'd want to also make sure that when those situations occur, that we're protecting senior water right holders from junior uses. So next, nearly 80 years after adoption of the code, the legislature recognized in-stream values. That is, that there are values to protecting water in-stream for fish and aquatic species, for watershed health, essentially, and water quality purposes. This is an important element for us, and it drives a lot of how we think and what we do and how we prioritize our actions. If you think from the standpoint that almost 80 years after adoption of the code, a lot of water rights had been, for out-of-stream purposes, had been approved and made use of by that time. And so trying to find a balance between in-stream and out-of-stream needs is challenging because of that. In 1989, we adopted a water allocation policy, and the purpose around this was essentially, again, to set ourselves up so that we're protecting senior users. This water allocation policy puts us in a position where we are mindful of not distributing new water rights unless we feel that that new water right can be met on a regular basis. And again, in doing so, we create some greater protection and reliability and predictability for the senior users in that system, so that we're trying to not over-appropriate the system, essentially. But we're also, we feel this benefits the applicant. While they may be disappointed if they can't get a new water right The reason we would not issue that under this policy is that we wouldn't feel that it would be a reliable resource, and perhaps would save considerable investment of time and money to try to develop a source that that wouldn't be accessible on a regular basis. So our agency mission is to serve the public by practicing and promoting responsible water management. There are a number of elements that are important to us in order to be able to carry this out. As I mentioned, you know, one key function that we have is to manage the distribution of water, and that occurs in the summer months. That's when everyone wants to use water, and as you are all aware, summertime is the time when we don't see as much precipitation, we don't see as much moisture, and that can create a lot of challenges for us in terms of making sure that we are allowing those senior users the water that they are entitled to. In order to be able to make good decisions, we need good data. We need good information about groundwater and surface water resources. And I would just point out on the slide here, there's a lot of work associated with that. On the left-hand side, you'll see a picture of these guys aren't ice fishing here. They're actually doing a stream measurement in southern Oregon, the Shuacon River, in the wintertime. We do field measurements on stream flows on a routine basis so that we can understand and have long-term solid data to be able to understand stream flows for the surface waters of the state. And one of the ways that we do that is physically going out and making measurements of those flows at different times of the year. We try to do these roughly every 4 to 6 weeks in different areas around the state. We also have stream gauges, and you'll see one on the far right-hand side of this slide. These are devices that allow the collection of stream flow data, and some of them we have telemetry devices where we can have that data be streamed back to offices. In other cases, we have to go collect that data on a routine basis. Regardless, those stream gauges must be maintained over time to make sure that they are accurate and accurately collecting data. One other element in the middle photo you'll see on the Wychus Creek. This is a fish passage facility, and you know, if you talked to that that person who claimed water on Shirttail Gulch and mentioned that he would need to put in a fish passage device, he probably would look at you in complete shock and wonder. But what this really suggests is that issuing water rights is a much more complicated process today than it was when people first started making uses of water in the late 19th century and early 20th century. A lot goes into it now in terms of being able to try to balance and protect interests in addition to the interest of the applicant for the water right. That includes considerations of endangered species under both state and federal endangered species acts, as well as Clean Water Act issues. We also underlying our mission, we have two goals, co-equal goals that we adhere to. And this, again, gets at some of the kind of the history element around that influences our activities. But the bottom line we have on these two is that one is an emphasis around protecting in-stream interests and stream flows and the recognizing the value of those stream flows for our economy, for our ecosystems, recreational purposes, quality of life. But also to be, on the other hand, to be looking at water supply opportunities, make sure that we're meeting the values and growing needs of communities around the state. Those sometimes can be tough to balance, as you can imagine. So this next slide, I want to talk just briefly about kind of what drives our strategies and priorities. And how we've framed our budget requests in very general terms. On the right-hand side of this slide, you'll see a picture of the cover of our Integrated Water Resources Strategy. And this is a document that the legislature actually got us, the department, and our commission moving on to develop a statewide strategy looking at to help guide our actions, to essentially be a roadmap and a compass for us in and how we operate and how we prioritize our activities. Very fundamental to that is the notion of we need to understand the resource in order to be able to make informed decisions, both from a real-time water distribution standpoint, but also in terms of being able to plan well for the future. We need to understand the surface water source, and we need to be able to understand groundwater resources. In addition to understanding that, we also need to have a good handle on what are the community needs. How are those changing? How are they growing? Are communities, do they have the same needs they've had in the past, or do they need to use water differently than they had in the past? Being able to do a crosswalk between understanding the resource in, for those communities and understanding their needs and going into the future is going to be extremely important for us to be able to develop solutions and potential ideas that can help them meet those needs both today and moving forward into future years. Another key element for us in terms of our strategy is just to put ourselves in a place where we can manage the distribution of water in accordance with the law as effectively and fairly as possible. And again, the data that we have to be able to do that is extremely important. Being able to have the staff resources to be able to carry that out and working with communities directly in the field and from Salem helps us to be able to carry out those functions as successfully as possible. In terms of budget investments, we have proposals that we'll talk about in more detail with you in the coming days. But there are three basic areas that we're interested in enhancing our resources to be able to carry out our priorities. One is integrated water resources development. And this is essentially, as Matt Stainer mentioned, we have a capital fund request that would capitalize funding for grants and loans that can be distributed to communities around the state who are interested in developing water resources for both out-of-stream and in-stream purposes. This is a program of great interest to us. It's something that we've been building toward for a number of years now, both through the development of the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, but also through some guidance from the state legislature and creation of some programs that already exist, Senate Bill 839 being one of them that was passed in 2013, but also Senate Bill 1069. Both of those provide the authority for us to issue grants, and in the case of Senate Bill 839, grants and loans that can fund projects that address water supply and conservation needs, as well as to be able to support feasibility analyses that are important for project ideas that need to be ground truthed and checked for their viability. So that is going to be an important element for us. We'll want to be able to make sure that you have a sense of what that involves, both in terms of the capital funds that we're proposing for that, but also for the staffing capacity. We are proposing a team of staff who can help manage the grants and loans and also work directly with communities in helping them to navigate through what can be a fairly complex body of law to understand what their best options are moving forward. Our budget is also designed around strengthening our core functions. And when I think about our core functions, I've already talked about how our field presence and our ability to be able to understand the resource and manage the distribution of water is important. And we have positions proposed that will help underscore those goals and desires for us. We also have a position that will be focused on the help us to address the demand that we have for water right related transactions, whether it's applications for permits or claims of beneficial use to certificate water rights or for transfers, we want to make sure that we're doing the best we can to keep up with that demand and provide timely responses to folks. And the last point here is we want to put ourselves in a position where we can help communities solve their water challenges. This water arena, as I'm sure you're all aware, in the arid West, there's a strong reputation for fighting in the water world. It really boils down to a very simple equation. When there's not much water to go around, it becomes a very important resource and can lead to tension in communities and that are very difficult to resolve. I certainly recognize that's a reality that we face in many parts of Oregon and in the West broadly. But I also think that we can do better than just fight each other over the resource. And one of the things that I think is important for our agency is to do what we can to help communities understand their options, to look at solutions in a collective, collaborative way. Our budget is in part designed to help provide those resources for us to be able to have a steady presence in those communities and help those communities who want to look at collaborative solutions for their long-term water supply needs. We think that, we think that's the best path to take. If for no other reason that we can point to many situations where conflict occurs, and that can be very expensive and take many, many years to resolve, and can create great friction within the community, which I don't think serves anyone well. Here we have a picture of our commission. Like many state agencies in Oregon, we are served by a volunteer citizen board, our Water Resources Commission. And I can tell you through my years of service with the state that this is a wonderful function for state agencies to have these citizen groups. They provide great value to the work that we do. These folks they're not working on water resources issues like I am on a every day hour after hour. But they do gain an expertise from a kind of a citizen standpoint and become a very important sounding board for us and kind of a reality check sometimes. And that's in general terms, I think these boards and commissions serve a very valuable function for state agencies from that standpoint. This group, their charge is to help us with prioritizing policy. Establishing policy with rulemaking as well. They are the final sign-off on any rulemaking that we do administratively. They have they're from different parts of the state. As you can see on the map here, there are five different discrete regions where we have a representative from each of those areas, as well as an east side at large and a west side at large. Good group of folks, and grateful to be working with them. Again, they had a major hand in working with department staff, with the public at large, and with our stakeholder community, as well as federal, state, and tribal interests in developing our integrated water resources strategy.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Director, when it comes to policy decisions, I think I heard you say that you run the policies through them. What is their relationship to the department as far as the development or the approval of or not of policies that would – how does that work in your department?
Co-Chair Senator Hansel, there are a couple of elements to that, and I'll give you a couple of examples. We work closely with our commission well in advance of a legislative session on ideas that we think are important around legislative concepts, for example, as well as budget packages. And it's important for us to work with them and get their feedback, and they will help us prioritize those issues in advance of submitting any of those proposals to the governor's office and ultimately to the legislature. So there's one area where we have interface with them and get good valuable insights. Another involves agency rulemaking. So for example, right now we're in the middle of a rulemaking to implement a program that will implement Senate Bill 839. This is the water supply grant loan program. We're working with them in meetings to keep them apprised of the efforts that we have underway with that program. And ultimately, in June, we're hoping to put a final rules draft in front of them for them to consider for adoption. So they have very direct authority there to adopt the rules, and they are the final decision maker in that regard.
Thank you.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Morning, Director. Could you talk to me for just a minute about the terms for these seven commissioners? If I'm not mistaken, two of them are up this year and five of them are up for renewal in 2017. That just struck me as a little curious.
Co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, I believe that two of them are up in 2016, and then the remainder are up, I think, a year or two after that. So you're right, and it is curious. These folks serve 4-year terms. They are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the state senate. In an ideal world, we would have them staggered strategically to be able to maintain kind of the institutional knowledge within the body. Sometimes the appointments process can be a little complicated. And we are not always able to move nominations when we'd like. And I think that what you see here and your observation is an astute one, is a kind of a consequence of some of those things happening. And it's been on my mind because I am concerned about making sure that we have that kind of institutional continuity.
Thank you, Director. I'm sure it's the Senate's fault one way or another. But.
No comment on that one.
Wise man.
Well, as long as we get acknowledgement of everything that's done right in this building.
Yeah. Right. You got it.
Yeah, we have an extra 5 minutes.
Anything? Any other questions? Mr. Bogner, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So here we have our a kind of a rough sketch of our organizational chart. As Representative Gomberg was asking, you know, the commission serves 4-year terms, as does the director. Both the commission members and the director are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, political appointees that are set to specific terms. When you looking at this, obviously we're within the executive branch, and we serve the governor in that regard. Our agency has 5 essential divisions, the director's office being one of those, but then our technical services division, field services, administrative services, and the water rights services division all work together, but also separately, carrying out important functions that help us serve the public in managing this important resource. So I'm not going to dwell on this, but I wanted to put this out there, and you can see the different kind of program areas. But with your permission, I would move then into our second chapter, in which I'll talk about these divisions in more detail.
Can I do a follow-up question?
Yes.
On Representative Gomberg's question here on the terms, if a vacancy occurs prior to the expiration of that term, the person that is replaced or does the replacement, do their 4-year term start immediately, or do they finish out the term of the person before? That may be why everything's getting bunched up. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hansel, I do follow, and I'm not sure that I know the answer for sure, but what I believe happens is that any new person who comes in will not fill the remainder of the term, but would be serving a new term of their own, because they would have to go through the appointments process as well. But I can follow up on that to make sure that's accurate information. Okay. So as I mentioned, we have five divisions within our agency, and I'm going to step you through the responsibilities of those different groups. I'm going to be very brief on this one, if only because on the bottom left-hand corner there's a picture that includes me, and I don't want to look at it for very long. So I'm going to try to step through this pretty quickly. But the director's office, as you've probably seen with many of the agencies, this is the group that leads policy direction. We work directly with our commission in organizing our meetings, developing agendas for those meetings, and helping to prioritize the direction of the agency. We in the director's office have responsibility essentially for all the day-to-day operations of the agency and oversee the functions of the other divisions of the agency as well. We also have responsibility and take the lead on intergovernmental relations, whether it means in working with you all, the state legislature, working with the governor's office, working with our congressional delegation, tribal governments, other state agencies, federal agencies, and local government. We are on point in establishing those communications, connections, and relationships that are important for us to be successful in the long run.
Question?
Yes.
On the upper right-hand picture, are you perfecting your water right on the mall? Is that what you're doing there?
Mr. Co-Chair or Co-Chairs, Senator Hansel, that is a well rig. I think there is a groundwater day typically every session where they have a suite of well rigs out in front. It's kind of intimidating, quite honestly. You know, and I'll tell you that there's another picture, and I don't know if it's where it is in this, but where there was actually a well being drilled at the beginning of the session. I don't know if you all remember, just on this side of the building, just on the little bit on the Senate side past the steps. And I got plenty of pictures of that because I thought that was a pretty unique opportunity to show how water supply is right here, right at the Capitol.
Well, Mr. Beiler, I think the problem with that is part of the expiration of the Capitol building, and I think the water table is about a foot below the basement, actually.
Could be. We got a drill. Start pumping.
Mr. Co-Chair, you know, you can have too little water, and you can have too much water, and that certainly can be an issue. Excuse me. In terms of communications, we are the point in the director's office in terms of outreach and communication with our stakeholders, but also with media requests. As I mentioned earlier, the Integrated Water Resources Strategy is a very important document for us to help us keep organized strategically and keep prioritized. It is the compass by which we engage in our efforts. And the maintenance of that document, and we will be looking to renew that document, I guess, looking at updating it within the next couple years. Performance improvement is also an area of focus for the director's office. Again, we oversee the day-to-day operations of the agency, and using performance measures, both the key performance measures that we work on with you all, but also our own internal ones to help us understand whether we're making progress or not on what we do is extremely important. And then the Water Resources Development Program. This is that capital-funded program that we feel is extremely important for us to be able to meet the community's water supply needs as we move forward is an area that the director's office has a strong interest in and relation with today. So I want to talk a little bit. I'm just going to wet my whistle here for 1 second. Hold on. Excuse me. Thank you. The Water Rights Services Division. This is the group of staff, about 38 FTE, who process and review applications of various kinds that we receive. And what I want to point you to here on this slide is the graphic here where you see application permit certificate. And I'll try not to go into this into too much detail, but it's important to have a concept around this, around what the kind of the essential ingredients are for a water right from the standpoint of the processing and kind of the at a certain elevation, I guess. when one wants a new use of water, they will submit an application to the department, groundwater, surface water, either one. Upon receipt of that application, that becomes the priority date for that water right. Very critical thing for any water right user to understand what their priority date is. It tells them where they are in the pecking order in terms of water distribution during times of short and dry years. Once we receive the application, we go through a review. We look at whether water is available. Is it a reliable source for them, or is it has that system been fully appropriated? We also will consider issues, as I mentioned earlier, around broad public interest, like Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, other range of public interest issues, prior to making a decision on whether to issue a permit. If a permit is issued, that essentially becomes a water right, but there's a responsibility for that the recipient of that permit to make use of the water. They have to then develop the water right. They can't develop the use first and then come in for an application. They have to come in with an application first, and then upon receiving a permit, they then have essentially permission to drill the well or to build the water delivery system and begin applying the water to the beneficial use that was received within the terms of the permit that they received. In very general terms, individuals have 5 years to make use of that water. And again, under the prior appropriation doctrine, there is a sense you need to keep using that water. There, you can't just sit on it and hold on to that right and not develop it. You have to make use of it in order to have the privilege of having a water right. And so, for most water users, kind of municipal users aside, there's a 5-year window for folks to develop the water right. If they are unable to develop it within that time frame, through no fault of their own, if they have good cause to continue and if they've been diligent in their development, they can receive an extension of time to continue development of that water right. Once they've fully developed the right, they can then apply to us a claim of beneficial use, which includes a record that can demonstrate the extent that they've used the water and where it's been used. And we will then review that final proof survey to be able to determine whether a certificate can be issued for that water right. And the certificate is really where every water right holder wants to end up. That is the most complete water right you can have. And as long as you keep using that water, you will have that in perpetuity. So that's an important element for this. And it's important to recognize for us, but as we issue each certificate, as long as people continue to use that water, they can hold on to that for a very, very long time. Another important element of having a certificate is that that enables one to be able to have a little bit more flexibility over their water use. What essentially that means is they can transfer that water use. They can change the type of use. They can change the place of use. They can change the point of diversion or the point of appropriation, depending on whether it's surface water or groundwater, so long as they can do so without injuring another existing water right holder.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question about that, Tom? It's also possible under certain conditions for somebody to lease their right to someone else. Is that not right? I'm thinking about that graph that we had, with the river coming down and the senior downstream, the junior upstream, and you mentioned that the junior, there could be a call on the water and the junior would not be able to use it. Could the two parties work out a deal between themselves that would allow that junior partner to take more? And if so, does that require the intervention or some kind of communication to the department, or is that something they can just do on their own?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Dembrough, so there are two elements, I think, to the question. So on the first, on the leasing piece, folks can temporarily transfer water, and with leasing, that is a term of art specific to temporary transfers of water to in-stream purposes. Well, I'll talk about that later in the presentation. The other element of your question was around whether there could be some kind of cooperative arrangement rather than just distributing water in accordance with priority, which can be a pretty blunt instrument at times. The answer is yes, that folks on a system can enter into agreements. They're called rotation agreements, essentially, that would allow them to, in a dry year, to share water or to have some kind of shared arrangement to distribute water so that everyone could make some use of the water, understanding that there's less there than in typical years. In those situations, it's extremely important that those folks work with the water master so that the water master understands and actually can be very helpful to inform those individuals what options they might have that can be done within the law. And so by and large, when those things happen, our staff are part of those conversations, and then we would help to administer the terms of those agreements. I think those are great approaches to take. We've seen some of those approaches happen in different parts of the state, most recently in the Klamath Basin, where we've just started to do regulatory actions there as a result of the adjudication. Some of the water users there have used that tool to be able to allow for many more folks to be able to use water, even though everyone's using a little bit less.
And is it possible for one party, for the party who's giving up some of their water, to be remunerated for that? I mean, you talk about sharing, but it could also be, in effect, they're selling the water to the other party. Is that possible?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Dembro, I will check with staff, but my sense is that as a contract between water right holders, that they would have that flexibility to be able to do so. Would not be the business of the department, but it would be the business between the two or more water right holders.
Senator Ansel.
Tom, what kind of workload does your department have on these? It would seem to me that with the history you've had of so much water development, that there may not be a whole lot of applications, but there may be at the same time. I'm just curious. And then also, is there a backlog here? What's a time frame from an application to a certificate? Mm-hmm. Well, kind of fill me a little bit on that.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hansel, I'll talk about this in more detail as part of the key performance measures, but we do continue to receive about 300 water right permit applications a year. Most of those are groundwater now, and as we'll touch on later in probably Tuesday or even Wednesday, there's not a lot of water available as you're recognizing for surface water sources during the times of year when people need it the most: spring, summer, early fall. So as a result, on surface, because of the surface water resources not available, folks are moving to groundwater. And so most of the applications we're receiving now are groundwater applications. That creates some challenges for us, quite honestly, because those are technically complex reviews. And we've been struggling to keep up with the workload on those because of the complexity of the hydrogeologic review associated with those and our desire to make sure that we're making good decisions around the resource. In terms of if you're okay with this, I can talk more about the workload associated with key performance measure number 10, where I'll go into that in a little more detail.
Are there any ability to get a water right application out of the Columbia River?
Co-Chair Senator Hansel, the short answer is yes. The long answer is it depends on how you go about it. One of the challenges we have in the Columbia River is Administrative Rule Division 33, which requires mitigation. For anyone to take water out of the Columbia River, they have to provide bucket-for-bucket mitigation to make up for that withdrawal out of the river. And that's created a pretty high bar for folks to try to figure out how to make that mitigation work. And as you're well aware, we've been working for many years with the communities in the basin to try to figure out ways to be able to make that work. You know, we're optimistic that we may have some answers in the near term for some of the irrigators in the community. But quite honestly, we've got a lot more work to do because I think there's other needs out in the basin that we'll need to look toward. But I do know there are options out there. But it does create a complex management system for us to be able to maintain, adhere to that Division 33 standard, but allow for continued development of water in that area.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Totally not my area of expertise. I just want to get some clarity around water rights. So I'm assuming we're talking when somebody has a water right that it is above ground, below ground, just anything that's on their property, they need to come to you and make application if they didn't already have the right. And is the right transferable upon sale? So now I sell a piece of property that has a water right and the next person gets to automatically own that, or do they have to go back through their own process? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, that's a great question. Earlier on in the presentation, I mentioned the concept of a pertinency, and a pertinency means the water is attached to the land. And so if there is a land sale, whoever buys that new property is going to immediately be the owner of that water right because it is attached to the land. They do not have to come to the agency to reapply for the water use.
Follow up? So if you buy a piece of property that doesn't come with a water right and you start like digging for a well or you find water on your property or something, has to go through that process, I'm assuming, then. Even if the water's on there and there was no right established prior to purchase, that you somehow find some water on your property that you've got to go through the department to get a water right established.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, by and large, that's true. The one exception is, with some caveats, is wells for domestic use don't require water rights. They're exempt from water rights. You know, there's over 230,000 of those wells around the state, but we do keep track and try to keep track of where those wells are because they do influence the aquifer systems. But not all uses of water require water rights. There are a class of exempt uses out there.
Okay, all right, please continue.
All right, thank you. So I think I'm going to, in the interest of time, keep moving because we've got a lot more here. So in addition to the Water Rights Services Division kind of being the storefront for folks who are looking to make new uses of water and reviewing the different transactions associated with that, we also, this division also has other important responsibilities, including adjudication process. The adjudication process is a statutory construct in our water code that gives us the authority to be able to determine and essentially issue water rights for uses of water that predated the 1909 code. Again, as we were talking at the outset, there were a lot of uses being made of water well before the 1909 code was adopted, and those water uses need to go through an adjudication process, which is part administrative, part judicial, in order to be able to have water rights, decreed rights, issued for them. These can be tricky processes. They are complex. They involve not only kind of the more typical uses, irrigation and other uses that you might see, but they can also be the process whereby federal reserved rights, these are rights to for the federal government to use water on their lands, and tribal reserved rights to be determined. And I'll give you an example of the complexity of these, and that's in the Klamath Basin. We began an adjudication process that is not yet over. We began it in 1975, and it immediately went into significant battles. We had two long court cases in federal court both of which went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. There were over 700 claims under the adjudication and over 5,500 contests, administrative contests to those claims that we had to sort through over that time period. We are now at a point where we have administratively made a final order of determination around those claims and submitted those to the Klamath Circuit Court, which has allowed us to, for the first time, just starting a couple years back, to be able to distribute water in accordance with those determined claims and the priority dates associated with those. So the point here being that until these pre-1909 water uses go through an adjudication process, the department is unable to regulate them. We can't distribute water for those uses. Most of Eastern Oregon has been adjudicated. There are significant areas within Western Oregon that have yet to be adjudicated. Based on our experience in the Klamath, we want to be pretty smart in terms of where we start our next adjudication and try to put ourselves in a position where we can move that process forward as expeditiously as possible. This division also, Senator Dembrough had hinted at this with his question about leasing, we also review processes that allow for people to transfer temporarily through leases or permanently through our transfer process water into to in-stream purposes. We also have an allocation of conserved water program that creates incentives for people to increase the efficiency of their water delivery systems, irrigation districts being a key participant in this program, where they might pipe the canal systems that they use to deliver water, thereby creating a more efficient delivery system. With the water they save through that effort, they are able to use some of that saved water for additional purposes, for their own purposes, as well as dedicate 25% of that saved water to in-stream purposes with a date similar, a priority date similar to the original water right. We also work with irrigation districts and municipalities on water management conservation plans. These are important for them to cast their eyes, help them to kind of cast their eyes into the future to make sure that they're planning for their future needs, to make sure that they are developing contingency plans in times of emergency, whether it's drought or other types of emergencies. Those are important tools for them to serve their patrons and citizens well, and we work with them on those. And lastly here, our hydroelectric program. Hydroelectric facilities around the state do require, we do require water rights for those uses of water. And we work with an interagency team. Our staff coordinate with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and staff from the Department of Environmental Quality in working with hydro facilities on new licenses, on reauthorization or decommissioning issues. As I mentioned a while back, data is really important to inform the work that we do and to help the water user community understand what options they have available to them. And our technical services division is the group that is behind all of that. These are our scientists, our hydrologists, hydrogeologists, GIS folks, as well as our information system folks that help make this data, collect this data and make it useful. With surface water, as I've mentioned, we collect data on roughly 250 stream gauges around the state. We make stream flow measurements in addition to that on a routine basis. And all of that data and those data sets are important. They're important in terms of the quality that we are able to develop of the information that we collect. But also the longevity of that data becomes very important for having those longer time periods of data sets. Really help us understand the systems that we're using water in a much better way. It informs the water allocation decisions that we have and the water availability decisions and construct, and also helps us with more near-time distribution of water issues. With groundwater, that's a similar story. We are striving to understand the resource. And here we have about 370 wells, observation wells, that where we measure groundwater levels in aquifers around the state. Our staff work with our field staff in making those measurements. This is increasingly important for us, as I mentioned a little bit ago, where we are at a point now in the state where surface water is not as available as it was. In fact, it's not available in many areas of the state when needed most. Many more folks are moving towards groundwater. And I'll talk in a day or two about some of the vulnerabilities that's creating and concerns that we're starting to see in some of the aquifer systems around the state, whether they're sustainable for new uses or not. Dam safety is another responsibility that we have. We have a responsibility for tracking dams that are 10 feet tall or higher that impound 9.2 acre feet, which is equivalent of about 3 million gallons of water. For those dams, and there are about 900 of them around the state, we keep track of those dams, work with the owners of those dams to make sure that they're maintained and constructed in a way that maintain public safety. And we have organized ourselves organized those dams into kind of a low risk, significant, and high hazard ratings. There are about 60 around the state that have high hazard ratings, and we're very actively engaged with the owners of those dams to take action to make sure that those dams are operating safely and not a threat to public safety. We do about 200 inspections of dams a year, and based in part on those levels of hazard rating levels that I mentioned. This picture, by the way, is inside of a dam. It's the Willow Creek Dam in the Malheur system. And so one of the things that our field staff or our dam safety inspector will do will actually crawl into these structures and take a look at the inside to get a sense of the integrity of the structure.
You say Malheur or Morrow?
Malheur.
Okay.
The Willow Creek system there that's west of Ontario.
All right. Yeah. There's a Willow Creek Dam. Okay.
Yep. That's why I wanted to make that clear.
Gotcha.
Okay, well construction and compliance. As I mentioned, there are a lot of wells around the state. Most of them are for domestic purposes that are exempt from water right requirements. We also have roughly 20,000 wells that have been constructed that operate under water rights. And we are seeing a surge of new uses to use groundwater because of the lack of availability of surface water resources. Our well construction and compliance section works with well drillers, the well driller community, on continuing education. We serve a licensing function with them. And the real purpose of this is we want to make sure that these wells are constructed in a really sound manner. If they're not, if they get into disrepair or if they're not constructed well, it can create contamination issues within the aquifer, which will have a much broader impact on the community of well owners who might be on that system. We want to avoid those situations whenever possible. There also can be issues in terms of waste of the water source through poor well construction or a loss of pressure to the artesian system, which can have negative implications for well users in that area. We strive for voluntary compliance where we can, but we do have the authority to enforce against folks who are not keeping up with the standards that we have for well construction under this program. And the last element here is our information services. And here, these folks work with our other folks in this section, as well as everyone else in the agency. These are the folks who manage our email services and our website. But probably most importantly, They're the ones who build the tools that help us take the data that we collect on surface water sources and groundwater sources, and as we analyze that data and make it meaningful to folks, our information services folks can create some really good tools that help people access that information in a meaningful way. They can also develop tools that will help us get information that's important to us. And on the screen here, I wanted to point out this is a device that helps well drillers locate wells that they drill through a map-based service here, where they can either give us the latitude, longitude of a well, or they can pull up the site that where they drilled the well and basically mark the screen, and which would then, that information would then come to us, and we would have a pretty darn good sense of where that well has been drilled. This is much, much more accurate information than we've had historically in terms of wells, are where those wells are located. And again, this is important to us because if those wells are not constructed properly, we need to know where they are. And in many cases, historically, reaching back, we don't have good data sets to understand where many of those wells are. So this is a great example of how technology and these information tools can be very helpful for us, both in terms of showing information, but also in terms of getting good data.
Tom, how is this service paid for? Is this paid for out of general funds, or is there a fee attached to drilling a well, use of groundwater?
I may ask for some help on this one, because I could I might be a little bit off. Can I ask Brenda Bateman to come up to help respond to that?
Absolutely.
I'm glad you asked the question, because it's good for these guys to get a little exercise this morning.
Thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department, Administrator for Technical Services. And in terms of paying for these services, a lot of our IS work, information services work, does come through our general fund. But specifically for well drilling, we do have a start card program for wells that are drilled, and then the starts or the beginnings of the drilling are reported to the department. That fee is $225. And then for some of the domestic wells, as were mentioned earlier under our exempt use program, there's a $300 fee so that we can report to the location, get that into the database accurately, and make sure that our records are correct in terms of location.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Please continue.
So I'm going to move to our field services division. These are the folks out in the field. We have about roughly 54 FTE in this program. They're the folks who are living in the communities that they serve. They're the water masters and associated technical folks who are working directly with the water user community, and they have kind of key, they're kind of two key functions that they serve. One, they are the front lines in terms of distributing water and working with directly with the water user community in that regard. So extremely, extremely important positions for us. You know, being able to communicate effectively with water right holders on what are sometimes very complicated issues can be very demanding for these staff, and they do a fantastic job. The other thing that they do when they're less busy not dealing with the regulatory season, they will spend a lot of time helping our technical services division with some of the measurement work. So what we'll see is that rather than sending our technical services staff who are housed in Salem out to Southeast Oregon to do a stream measurement or a groundwater measurement, we'll have our field staff collect that data for them, which creates some efficiencies for us and works quite well. These staff will also help with dam inspections and also on well construction issues. So there's really good synchronicity between our technical services division and responsibilities they have and the field services division to help collect a lot of the data that they pull together. Just in terms of these pictures here, this is a tagline. I initially thought that was a big magnifying glass that that guy was holding on the left, but it's actually one of our staff persons is holding a tagline, which measures, I believe, the depth of the well. Looking, if you see head nods, that's a good sign. And on the right, we have a staff person who's doing a stream flow measurement. Again, one of those physical stream flow measurements in areas where we may not have a stream gauge to be able to cover that that information. So these folks are, as I mentioned, extremely important to us for the work that they do. But they also, I have a lot of respect for what they do because they have to be really, they have to know a lot of information. They have to be generalists in many ways and be able to understand a wide breadth of programs. They aren't just working on a discrete program area like some of our other staff. These folks really have come across almost every kind of situation you can imagine that could implicate a wide variety of different programs within our agency. So we're really pleased with the level of expertise and the dedication that we have with our field staff. And I want to recognize they have a tough job.
Senator Hansel.
I was just going to reemphasize that, if I may. My experience in Umatilla County, the working relationship and the expertise, I just say absolutely to what you've just said on the how well they work together and give them a real shout out. They do a great job.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hansel, thank you. We'll definitely pass that along to folks out there. So I wanted to give you a sense with this slide of the how we're organized in the field. We have five regions, and each of those regions has a regional office that's led by our regional manager. Northwest, Southwest, South Central, Eastern Oregon, and North Central Oregon, as you can see on this map. Within those regional offices, we have 21 water master offices, and the water master really is that frontline staff person who does the primary activities around distribution of water, often is the first person who's called when there are questions that come in locally, and they have significant workload. I would say that also, just to give context around the amount of issues that can come up, we have about 80,000 surface water rights distributed across the state. We have probably roughly 250,000 wells, both exempt uses and permitted uses around the state. These folks are trying to track all those uses around the state.
Ms. Beiler, if you could complete in the next couple of slides. My apologies for being out of the room so often. I think the House members will understand. We have a 50-17 up on the Senate floor at 10:30, and we both have Democratic and Republican caucuses at 10. But we will not break your record in terms of time either on this or previous bills. I don't predict. So
Senator Hansel and Senator Dembro. So yeah.
So if you could just complete the next couple of slides, and then we'll adjourn for today.
Co-Chair Senator Devlin, we're in good shape for that, actually. I have two slides left, and this is one of them. So the main point here is that significant workload for these folks. One of our water masters down in Region 10 has 11,000 square miles in her district. One site visit can take all day or more. We have another in District 18. It's our smallest district up in Washington County, but there's 500,000 people there and a lot of issues around water but very different worlds from in the experiences those two water masters have are quite different. So just to give you a flavor of that. And lastly, and not least, certainly, is our Administrative Services Division. This group provides very core services for us in terms of our fiscal services, our business operations, as well as our human resources services. I think those go without saying in terms of the accounting work, the personnel work, the management and development of our budget are all associated with those. What this group, though, has increasing responsibility over is our grant and loan programs that are, again, tied to these water supply efforts that are underway both through the past bills that have been passed and this current budget request that we'll be talking about with you over the coming days. This program will have responsibility for oversight and administration of those grant and loan programs as we move forward. So what I would mention here, just in the bottom left-hand corner, you'll see the big pipe. That's a piping project in Central Oregon that received a feasibility grant to help develop kind of the viability for that project from the grant from the Water Resources Department. This group also is our front desk, reception desk in the Salem office. They man those positions. And in the top right-hand corner is the Gold Star certificate from Department of Administrative Services for our fiscal and financial work. We've received that recognition for 22 years running. We're very proud of the work that our staff do. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Byron? Seeing none today, well, thank you very much, and I guess we'll be back here tomorrow at 8:30.
Thank you.
You'll be back.
We'll come
back. Might still be in session.
Oh, sure.